Hello, this is Jill Pasternak. Welcome to Crossover, the program that explores the universal language, music. Music of Johann Sebastian Bach, the first movement of his sonata in G minor, BWV 1020, performed by our guest today, Robert Stallman, flutist, with Edwin Swanborn at the harpsichord. I want to welcome again a guest we haven't seen for quite a while, flutist Robert Stallman. Welcome back to Crossover, Bob.
I am so happy to be back here with you, Jill.
I have to tell you, every time I see you, I say whatever album you've released, this is the greatest album you've ever done. So I'm going to say it again. This is absolutely a wonderful album. It's the Bach Sonatas for Flute and Obbligato Harpsichord. And for our audience, please explain what an obbligato is.
Obbligato means you're obliged to play what's written. In other words, it's the opposite of playing a continuo part, which means you would play... See, Bach's left-hand bass part, and then you'd make up the chords like a jazz artist would do in jazz, but not in that idiom, of course. And you would add the chords of harmony and maybe some interesting counter melodies in the right hand. So there's a lot of freedom there. But this is the difference is that Bach created the so-called trio sonata or the obbligato sonata, where the harpsichord now has an equal voice in the right hand to the solo violin or solo flute or whatever you have there.
Now, a trio being
so
in this
trio.
Case.
So it's a trio. So you have bass in the left hand. You have, let's call it alto in the right hand in the harpsichord, and you have soprano in the flute. In Bach's terms, it just means it was actually a new style of composition. Not that Bach had invented the obbligato sonata, but he took what others had begun and made it into a perfected art form. He took the idea of a trio being played by two instruments, very economical.
I was going to say it does.
But what that does is, of course, it eliminates the gamba player or the cello player who would normally double the left-hand part. So he was out of a job. But the harpsichordist was now much more in prominence.
I see.
And that was his instrument, Bach. And so he developed this. And what this led to was, of course, the sonatas for violin and harpsichord, violin piano.
But they're not necessarily obbligato sonatas.
Pardon?
They are not called obbligato sonatas.
These are called obbligato sonatas.
Yes, this particular.
Right, but later
others,
with Haydn and Mozart and Schubert and Beethoven,
they
just call it sonata.
A sonata.
For guess what? For piano and violin or piano and flute.
Piano was
more important.
I see.
It has two parts.
Of course. That's right. And save money up to other
But Bach, the foundation for the sonata is with J.S. Bach. His son, Carl Philipp Emanuel, was the next one to develop the trio sonata further. He wrote over a dozen so-called obbligato sonatas for flute and harpsichord.
Thank you.
Music of Johann Sebastian Bach from his Sonata in B minor, BWV 1030. We heard the Largo e Dolce performed by Robert Stallman, flutist, and harpsichordist Edwin Swanborn. I want to ask you another thing. Whenever we speak with you, you are terribly knowledgeable. Is that part of what you do, or is that just it's something that you want to know about? But also, when you prepare something, it's very, very important to know what goes on behind the scenes.
I'm a curious guy. I like to know. I need to know as much as I can about the composer whom I love, whom I'm playing, whom I'm representing, whom I'm interpreting. You have to have a feeling for the person as a human being and to know something about his habits. I mean, the fact that Bach, when he composed, often smoked a pipe and drank either beer or punch and coffee. These things are interesting.
Well, it's interesting in a sense, but I'm talking about as far as your interpretation, for instance. I mean, even the title, it's Bach Sonatas for Flute and Obbligato Harpsichord. Okay? Is that right? That's the title.
Yes, you got it right.
So a lot of people will say, what does this obbligato mean? I mean, a lot of people really just don't know. They just, flute and harpsichord, you know.
If they buy the recording, open the version.
Yes.
Right there in the first part, okay. You'll get the definition.
Well, what I'm saying, of course, is that you are really you're not only a perfectionist, you're very, very interested in finding out what made the composer tick.
Exactly.
And where he lived. And that's one
of the
things.
Well, that's what you're interested in, too.
And that's what I wanted to say to you. This, especially the liner notes for this album, are just stupendous. You and your wife, I believe,
yes,
wrote them, Hannah.
Yeah,
and what I wanted to say was, when I listened, I kind of just scanned the notes and I said, they're scholarly, but they create an ambiance when you know this wonderful cafe.
Yes, let's talk about that.
The wonderful cafe that, well, you've named, isn't that your, the Bogner's Cafe is your...
Bogner's Cafe is our label, and it's an actual place in Vienna where Mozart and Schubert hung out.
But this is what it was. They hung out. Now, we are brought up not even to think that people, you know, hung out in those days. I mean, that was a real mecca for artists and for musicians. And you could just picture them especially when you read the notes. You just kind of sitting there, maybe smoking a pipe and kind of talking about the business and what.
Yes.
And you create that ambiance. And I have to tell you, that's so very, very important because, you know, usually the notes are, you know, that this was done this and that was published in this date and it was premium. This is a feeling there that you're there. You're
well,
in
thank
that
you.
Place. And
I
think it's really
Hannah
important.
And I take our time. We study, we read. Dozens, literally dozens of books and reread other books. And you can see a wall of Bach books, a wall of Schubert books, a wall of
but
Mozart books, and there are all Post-its in them.
But it's beyond what was going on at the time. It's just there's, as I said, it's an ambiance. You create this.
Oh, good.
You can feel the fireplace.
Well, that's what we want to do because that's
amazing.
In effect why we named our label Bogner's Cafe. It's a virtual cafe in a sense. There's this feeling of intimacy, and that's the way our engineer mics our recordings with just two great microphones, natural sound. And you get the ambience of the hall or the church where we record.
Yes.
So if you picked up on that, that's wonderful because that's what we're trying to do.
And I urge the people who get the album, which is, again, Bach Sonatas for Flute and Obbligato Harpsichord, Bogner's is the label. And is that available? How does one get discs these days?
And that's with Edwin Swanborn again on harpsichord.
Oh, yes. Wonderful.
Well, you get them through Amazon or through Archive online.
Okay. And you can do that online.
Yeah.
I urge whoever is listening to get this album. It is just breathtaking. Thank you. From the sonata in B minor, BWV 1030, we've heard the presto, A Gigue, performed by Robert Stallman, flutist, and Edwin Swanborn, harpsichordist. Of course, whenever I interview Bob, I'm always kind of saying, this was wonderful, and this was one of your best performances. So I think I'm not the only one that feels this way. But it's a while since you've released an album, is that right?
Well, yeah, we normally would put one out a year, but we've had some... I won't get into it, but some personal problems. Mm. An accident. My wife was in a taxi accident.
Oh, my.
And et cetera. So it set us behind for a while. But now we're back on a roll. And the next recording after this will be another Mozart recreation of four piano sonatas as quartets for flute, violin, viola, cello.
Now, as far as the flute, the instrument, is concerned, were there changes from the time of Bach?
Oh, yes. Okay, now... Bach, let me start this way. When Bach started to write music in his teens, he wrote for the flute in the most simple way because the only flute playing he knew was pretty basic. And the recorder took the place of the flute when things got fast and difficult.
Well,
because nobody could play it in Germany. Nobody could play... You know, allegros, they didn't know how. But in France, they were already very advanced. What happened was a fellow named Pierre-Gabriel Buffardin, B-U-F-F-A-R-D-I-N, from Provence, let's say Marseille, near Marseille,
yes.
Ends up in Dresden at the court and at the opera, his first flute. He's an amazing virtuoso. He ends up teaching Cavance, okay? He and Blavet, Michel Blavet in Paris, are the greatest flutists of the whole era, the Baroque era, by far. Bach, luckily, goes to Dresden for the first time in 1717. So he's, what, 32? To battle with, to have a contest, the famous contest with Marchand, the organist from Paris. And you remember Marchand left town very early in the morning and did not face Bach after the contest. So Bach put a concert... there, and he had friends in the orchestra. The first violin, Pisandel, and the famous lutenist was also there, Weiss, and others. Mm-hmm. Okay, and the Hassas were there. Faustina, the great soprano, and her husband, the great composer. So he was surrounded by friends, and he undoubtedly first met the great flutist Buffardin early on in 17. He comes back to Dresden in 1724. Now he's been in Leipzig a year. He's moved to Leipzig to take up the post at St. Thomas Church and to write all those incredible cantatas and oratorios and, right. And passions. And by 1724, a year later, he starts writing really difficult flute parts in the cantatas. They're of a level of difficult violin parts.
So
suddenly he says, wait a minute, this flute from France, which you always call La Flûte Traversière.
Oh, that's
it. Never called Flauto Dolce.
I know, yeah.
Flauto Dolce means recorder, but La Flûte Traversière was a new instrument in Germany in a way.
It was held in a different way.
It's traverse. It's traverso, yeah. But it's wooden and it's conical. In other words, it's tapered down the end, whereas now the modern flute is cylindrical and almost always in metal, although people do play wooden flutes still. Anyway, so he hears this. I mean, everything with Bach is conjecture because we don't have a lot of solid facts. Mm-hmm. But it makes good sense that he must have met Buffardin because he was the first flute in the orchestra. He certainly heard him.
And he probably
Because Buffardin, this is very interesting, had taught J.S. Bach's brother, whose name was Johann Jakob, in Constantinople of all places.
Okay.
Because Jakob was in the army and played flute. And took lessons with the great Buffardin earlier. And so it was natural for Bach to say, I'm so happy to finally meet you. You know, my brother tells me all about you. You can imagine. So then in 24, he starts writing these very difficult and beautiful and profound. He doesn't take the flute lightly like a lot of composers.
Right.
He goes for the soul of the instrument. And
But is that in a lower... key or
no? It's not a matter of key. It's just a lot of them are in minor keys. It's true. They're more
yes.
More serious, perhaps. But also they're brilliant ones. The Cantata 8, is very chipper. It's it has a two florid obbligato parts. I think Cantata 114 is another one that has this one in E minor that's so dark and soulful and difficult because he says,
"Oh, I've heard Buford now.
If he can phrase like a violinist, then others will have to do it too. And I'm only writing for Buffernet and the future."
We've just heard the Allegro from the Sonata in A Major, BWV 1032 by Johann Sebastian Bach. And we're speaking today with flutist Robert Stallman about his latest album with harpsichordist Edwin Swanborn, the Flute and Obbligato Harpsichord Sonatas by Johann Sebastian Bach. So what happens is now, of course, all of his dreams came true, once the modern instruments, of course, have been made, and you can do all these things and make it sound just like he wanted.
Well, you know, that's interesting because I think that if Bach could hear a lot of the modern oboe, the modern bassoon, the spectacular playing on the trumpet and the French horn. And,
I wonder what he'd say.
He'd be absolutely thrilled. He was a progressive. He invented some instruments, you know.
Yeah. No, I don't.
Oh, yeah. He invented the viola pomposa, which is some crossbreed between a cello and a viola. I've seen one in a museum.
It's a viola.
It's pomposa. It's a large viola.
Yeah. Well, I think he was a genius, and I mean, there's no question about it, but I think the fact that this impacted on the way he composed, I mean, there's no question.
I think it's true of any great composer and most composers that they are inspired by a voice or by a musician.
And
they write, they tailor the music to that person. And otherwise, it's too vague. It doesn't, you know, you have to have something concrete
to identify with. Absolutely, yeah. I think so. But this is what you're saying, and I'm sure our audience must feel this right now. All of this extra, all this information, you set the stage, you create, as again, the whole aura of what was going on, the air he was breathing, the people were smoking in the cafe. I mean, of course, it was a very rough time. It was hard. They didn't have lights, you know, and I mean, it was a hard thing to be a musician. It was cold and all the things that we talk about, the instruments are cold, my hands are cold, or the light isn't good, I can't see. Well, too bad. I mean, you know, in those years, they made do with what they had. And this is what is so, I find, inspiring every time I speak with you, and I'm sure the audience must feel that way. You bring it to life, and you make it sensible, and you it's not just a something that you throw away and you say, oh, another Bach sonata. It's not. It's
now,
very
Bach is,
special.
I really feel that he is he's a real person with great passions, with a great sense of humor. He had a very big temper. If you push him too far, he would snap, and that would be it. Otherwise, he was very patient. He embraced friends. They all stayed at his home. The place was just like a hotel. I mean, there were people there all the time. The children, the wife,
lots of activity.
Always people coming through, and he's always playing for people. He always tuned his instruments, and he had a clavichord and at least one harpsichord that he tuned always.
Now, what happened? How did they tune? Did they have a tuning key?
Well, you know, Bach tuned the well tempered. He tuned so that he could play an F sharp major or for that matter, A flat minor. Okay. I mean, he could play any key. Look at the well tempered clavier. That's what it's about. He tempered it so that he could play it. In his day, the limit was four sharps, four flats.
Really?
You couldn't go beyond that. It was like you drop off the edge of the world. I mean, that was the end because you stretch the thirds to the point where you're out of tune.
Mm-hmm.
And you might, if you went to E major, maybe make a little adjustment for the G sharp or something.
I see.
But yeah. you couldn't just go around from one thing to another. Yeah. And he said, this is nonsense. He was so progressive.
Well, exactly.
If you tune this way, we can play every key. And so the whole point of the Weltemer Clavier is you go from C major, da-da-da-dee-da-da, yeah. you know, and then the next one, C minor. And
C
then the
minor,
next one,
D,
guess what?
D.
C sharp major.
Oh, C sharp, well, okay.
Nobody could play it. Nobody ever played that in that key before.
Okay.
I mean, it was like, you know, what's he doing here?
So I think even that, this whole idea of explaining the Weltemper Clavier is a lesson, actually, in tuning the instrument and playing in certain, I mean, I'm sure a lot of pianists wouldn't feel that way. In any case, here we are with your Bach sonatas and the Edwin Swanborn. Tell us a little bit about him. He's a brilliant harpsichordist.
Yes, he is. And we've been playing together for 40 years or so. I mean, a lifetime, really. And I think this is our eighth or ninth recording together. This is the last recording we could make in New York in the beautiful church of the Good Shepherd on the east side, because Verizon, if I may say that in the air, had put in a compressor or whatever it's called.
It made sense.
And it was going, you know, 24/7. And the sine tone was right, like middle C, or you know, B natural, right in the middle. So you can't do anything with that. If it's the way it went in, you can get rid of it.
But, wrong key.
So that was our last. So this is actually our last recording there in this beautiful church.
Okay. So this is then, once again, part of you're envisioning a two CD.
Yes,
volume,
we want to finish up. I think we'll probably do it either this summer or in September. We'll finish with the other continuous.
Now, are you performing anywhere recently?
Yeah, well, I'm here right now. I'm going off to California in 2 weeks for a 3 week tour.
And will you be premiering this?
No, I'm not going with the harpsichord. I'm playing recitals with piano actually this time.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but we've played these pieces. I mean, so many over the years. Countless places in France and all over the United States.
And they're just wonderful and very, well, of course, the performance is outstanding. And we're so thrilled to have you. We want to keep up with you and keep us posted. Where will you be playing in the area at all?
Yeah, I'll keep you posted.
Hear now the sonata in E-flat major, BWV 1031 by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Robert Stallman, flutist and harpsichordist Edwin Swanborn. We've just heard Johann Sebastian Bach's Sonata in E-flat Major, BWV 1031, performed by flutist Robert Stallman and harpsichordist Edwin Swanborn. This is from their newest album, Evenings at Zimmerman's Coffee House, Johann Sebastian Bach's Sonatas for Flute and Obbligato Harpsichord.
What happened with Bach was that he signed on as director of Zimmerman's Coffee House.
That's right.
Remember
very
Zimmerman?
Famous. Sure. Well,
yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Hardly.
Well, the building is still there in Leipzig.
Is that the one they turned into a veterinarian's? You told me about that.
No, that's Boger's Cafe.
Oh, okay.
It had been. And now it's I don't know what, because the last time I was in Vienna, they were repainting the inside. And I don't know, maybe it's a nail parlor. I don't know.
Okay.
I hope it's a cafe.
Okay.
And my friends.
So tell us about
Zimmerman.
But
back to Bach. So what happens is Bach, after 6 years at the St. Thomas Church, he's written over 200 cantatas in 6 years. It's staggering.
He had to write one for every
Sunday. And he would have continued
every Sunday.
He would have continued, yes. But after 6 years, he's totally burnt out. And he only feels his hostility, envy, and he says, quote, unquote, envy and persecution from the authorities, from the administration of the church, of the school where he taught. He had to teach all these kids, and then also from the town council. And a lot of these pompous burger bureaucrats he had to deal with, trying to restrict him. And they didn't really like his music. It was too complicated.
Well, they probably didn't understand it,
of course. Just wanted gallant, nice, easy, Telemann-esque kind of, and Bach was writing Bach. And so he said, to hell with them. And I'll take on this job at Zimmerman's because they're asking me.
And what was the job?
Here was the job. The job was he was in charge of the concert series in the coffee house. This is a new idea that you play music in a coffee house, in a court for the rich, for the aristocracy,
it was for the public.
And not in a church. It was for the public. It was for the bourgeoisie.
Now, what year is this?
This would be 36, I think it is, So he takes this on. Now, he sees the advantage of doing this. First of all, he can focus on a different kind of compositional emphasis.
It was approved. I mean, he didn't have to get permission.
They didn't say you can't do that. He was doing both things.
I see. So, okay.
But he could recycle his cantatas. He was safe for a long time. Okay. And so what he does is he brings in his top students, his two or three top brilliant sons, CPE and Wilhelm Friedemann, to play concertos with him. He refashions the violin concertos from Curtin as harpsichord concertos. Yeah. And we wouldn't have these concertos probably unless he had taken on this job. And he'd reached a crisis in his life, midlife crisis. He was 44.
Right. Well, it's long in those
days. Yeah, and he'd reached this, and he'd been sort of just thrown out by the people who hired him. They didn't understand him, and he wanted to leave town, but he couldn't. He had a family, and so he was trying to get a job in Dresden, and he kept going back there from where he played there. But this was a new kind of creative source for him.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and from this he wrote the flute sonatas, and most likely for who else? Buford.
These.
Yes, these four.
You know, as you're talking about it, even I don't know what it is. I feel the ambiance of that place. I hear you say, yes, it's Zimmerman's, and this is what he wrote there, and they were listening and drinking, and
yes, they were.
What is the reason? No, I really wonder what that is, because it's a kind of a magical thing that happens.
Yeah.
You or whatever has created the whole atmosphere, and it takes on the music takes on a different feel.
So, Leipzig was it was called the Little Paris. It was a very affluent city.
Yeah.
It was the trade center in that part of the world. And twice a year, a month or 6 weeks, or it was a long period. There were trade fairs, and everybody came in, and so Bach could meet people. He could buy music, and by the time Bach had finished with his directorship, I think he was there for about a total of 8 years. He resigned for a year and came back for two more. So at least 6 or 7 or 8 years. He had 1,200 hours of music, not all his own, had been performed there.
My goodness. Yeah. 1,200 hours.
Now, it wasn't
How
always,
long were they? Were they open all night? Were they open all night?
They were open late. And there were two rooms. There was a room close up, a room far back, apparently. And you came in, you had a coffee, and you smoked a pipe, and you listened. And it's mainly for serious listening. They had maybe, I would guess, one rehearsal, so it was like very fresh. Mm-hmm. They had to make sure there weren't mistakes in the written parts.
Right.
And they went off.
That takes care of the rehearsal.
Wouldn't you love to have been there?
Yeah, right. Can you imagine on the manuscripts? Oh, yeah. Dear. We've been speaking with Robert Stallman, virtuoso flutist, and I would say one of the most interesting people I've ever met.
Jill, thank you so much. It's just always a great pleasure to be here and to see you again.
We look forward to another album and also perhaps another conversation.
Good. Let's do it.
We've been speaking with flutist Robert Stallman about his latest album with harpsichordist Edwin Swanborn, the Bach Sonatas for Flute and Obbligato Harpsichord, Evenings at Zimmerman's Coffee House. The album is available on the Bogner's Cafe label, and their website is aboutbognerscafe.com. I'm Jill Pasternak. Until next time.
For a second listen to selected Crossover interviews, visit WRTI.org. Crossover was produced by Jill Pasternak in the studios of WRTI Philadelphia for the WRTI Radio Network. This is Joe Hattie, Crossover's technical producer. Crossover is syndicated nationally by Global Media Group Incorporated. Thanks for listening.